When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, but it rips so hard.
Yes.
Like, it's like I feel like talk about this all the time, but the way it starts with the hurdy-gurdy man scene, it just like, it's such hard dick energy. Like, to just start your fucking movie off like that, like I don't know, that scene just like goes so hard, and it's such a like iconic use of that song. Like, I don't think I've even heard, no, I probably have. But if I have heard Hurdy Gurdy Man used in another song before, it's clearly just like, it's not, you know, in my mind as much as Zodiac is.
Yes.
Like, I feel like it just, it's such a poignant use of it. And then it, when it brings it back at the end, oh, ties everything right back up. But no, it's just like, I don't know. I feel like I'm always like, there's another movie I've been thinking about. It's just like in the back of my mind rewatching. I think it's Days of Heaven. And Zodiac is also kind of like always in the back of my mind wanting to do a rewatch of it.
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle, a 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac. Adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by screenwriter James Vanderbilt, the film, of course, stars an incredible ensemble led by Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Our introduction today was a writer whose work can be read at Film School Rejects, Thrillist, Little White Lies, and Bright Wall Dark Room, Brianna Ziegler. Before we dive into the theme of the week and the show proper, I'd love to remind you to jump on and rate and review the show wherever you're listening. It's a huge help for those fellow lovers of puzzles or people who like going to the library like Mr. Graysmith, and anyone who loves obsessive movie deep dives. I also want to let you know that the links to our Patreon with our weekly Rum and Rant podcast and uncut Zodiac session interviews and links to our merchandise with artwork by the incredible Brianna Ashby and Amy Reid are in the description below. Joining me today to discuss the aching regret of letting a suspect lumber away from a crime scene without stopping them are internet movie news trailblazer, editor-in-chief of darkhorizons.com, the man machine, my dear friend, Mr. Garth Franklin.
It's complicated because I find it's that first hour of the film works gangbusters for me.
Yeah.
There is a real emotional feeling that was actually goes through. This is the part where the acts of violence actually happen. This is the part where the investigation feels like it has a real forward momentum. And then you hit the point where everything stalls.
Co-host of the Cinephiles podcast, the chief instigator of our brand of cinematic deep dives, my dear friend, Stu Coo.
On our show, we've got like the sin of envy. And I am starting to be envious of people who love this movie.
Yeah.
Because I acknowledge that it's almost faultless the way it's made. Mm-hmm. It's meticulous. Everything is outstanding from a design point of view. But I can't...
It's not penetrating.
I can't come away from the fact that there is no heart and soul to it.
And returning, senior editor and critic at Rolling Stone and the former editor of Time Out New York, David Fear. New York Times bestselling author, James Patterson collaborator, Ned Kelly Award winner, Australia's premier crime writer, Candace Fox. Senior contributor at Film School Rejects, Meg Shields, host of Prog Save America podcast, the creator of A Year With Women and Noirvember, Mariah Gates, editor-in-chief of Fangoria, executive producer of Horror Noir and Shudder's upcoming queer horror doc, Phil Nobile Jr., and contributing editor at Nerdist, Lindsay Romaine. This is the seventh episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Aries Part 1. This sequence is dominated by three rapid-fire exchanges that have ramifications for the rest of the film. They encapsulate the agony of missed opportunities, the bursts of hope that a community's focus can unearth this elusive tormentor, and a quartet of men being consumed by this monster. I could not think of a film to better encapsulate those feelings than Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation. Before we dive into the scene proper, here's Candace Fox theorizing on the frenzy that occurs when a serial killer grips a town.
I've never been written a letter, and their motivation. I've never experienced that. I've had letters on everything you can imagine, but not. They never question who done it or why. I just think it's that people don't know. And that's what keeps them coming back, to try to find out why people do these sorts of things. And it's the desire for participation. This is the thing with the Zodiac Killer and the Zodiac case, is that you can still participate in it, the real case, and also in the film. You can sit there and try to guess, because with things like the Golden State Killer and BTK and all that, it's like, we know the answer, we've caught him, you know, so we're just going to show you how we caught him. But, you know, I watched Zodiac with judging it and going, I think there's something in there, you know, and people want to participate. I have always been fascinated by the people in and around the crime of the serial killer, you know, because I have known a serial killer myself quite well. And you think to yourself, he's in jail now, he's just sitting there rotting like he should be. But actually, he's incredibly busy, because he's got four girlfriends and they're all in different countries and they're fighting with each other. He's got true crime people trying to hassle him for his, you know, his unsolved cases. Did you have anything to do with this? You know, there are people who are writing to him angry. So he's just getting all of this stuff, you know, and it's the same when there's a murder. You have people falsely confessing to it. There are people trying to offer information on it. There are people who, you know, have theories, and it's just it just fascinates human beings, I think, because I don't know, there aren't that many real critical predator danger types in our life. Like, if you don't go into the ocean, you don't have to worry about sharks. It's okay. So you don't have a predator, you know. And if you don't live where there are lions, then you don't have to worry about lions. So our brain, I think, is searching for a threat sometimes, and killers and rapists and that kind of thing. They're our predators, and we like to think about them and give our brain something to do with all its terror.
When we left off, the camera has delicately pirouetted around Anthony Edwards' Bill Armstrong on a game of jurisdictional phone tag. In the final revolution, the blurred huddle of Toski, Captain Marty Lee, played by Dermot Mulroney, and patrolmen Fook and Zelms, played by Peter Quattaroli and Jeff Callan, begins to frame and encroach on the close-up. As Armstrong swivels, the focus pulls and brings Toski's urgency into sharp focus. Patrolman Fook has his hat in his hand. His strong eyebrows hang. Let's dive into the scene.
Okay. Bill. Can I have a word with you?
Fincher and legendary cinematographer Harry Savides frame the two officers' descent into the waiting room chairs, with the legs of the partners bordering the scenes like goalposts. The voices of the detectives are heard first. Folk reflects the gravity of what's happening. Zelms needs to believe in the procedures in order to sleep at night, and who can blame him? There's an absolute intensity in Toski's gaze. Armstrong's reaction is one that's immediately haunted. He's having a premonition about the exchange and carrying through the fear from his ring around in the previous scene. He's looked like he's seen a ghost during Nalo's explanation of the crime scene, bundled into a blanket and the Windwalker boots. And now this.
Where did you see this guy?
You got the call to circle the scene, look for a Negro male.
Where was he?
on Jackson, heading east about the middle of the block.
And this is 3 minutes after the shooting?
Give or take, yeah.
And you're heading east or west?
We are going west.
You're on Jackson, going west. So the cab was one block catty corner southwest?
Correct.
Every detail is re-clarified. The gravity of the miss cannot be understated. It's a double technique. It shows the interrogation craft as a reflex, and it shows that these men simply cannot turn off once they're on. The camera shift, it's a mid-shot for both pairings. Toski and Armstrong are positioned to judge, and the officers Folk and Zelms are pleading their case. Before we reach the conclusion of the scene, here are Garth Franklin, Stu Coote, and I discussing the perils of missing what's racing away from a scene when you're racing towards it.
That, I really like the way they do that. Like, we done fucked up. Like, but again, it's information, it's communication. Like, at the time, we were looking for this. We stopped a guy. And it was funny, I was watching this because I was like, every, you know, wherever there are, like, cops racing to somewhere, like, they're, you know, you're, or an ambulance driving, they've either got a body in the ambulance or they're going to someone that needs them. And it's very hard. You get such tunnel vision. It's very hard to see what's going the other way. Like, it takes a very sort of switched on person to go, oh, maybe we don't need to rush to this thing. Maybe, like, because we're going there really quick. And if, like, the bank robbers are going away really fast, there's a good chance we're not going to be ready to see them when we get there. So it's just, and I can see those guys, they're jogging on the spot. A little bit of sort of, because there's an implications, a little bit of racism, like, you know.
Yeah, well, they kind of agree of the systemic racism, and I think it's like that whole thing.
Like, we stopped a white guy, okay, he looked all right, he had a crew cut, he's sort of in army boots, like, wasn't doing anything outwardly wrong, so
and they're like, did you stop him?
Yeah.
And they're like, I think the inference at the beginning of the conversation is what I love, is like, yeah, we stopped him, or we slowed down.
Yeah.
And they're like, I love Armstrong, because when Armstrong's on, it's that's what's so perfect about that three-way conversation. Armstrong and Toski both have this great habit of making people repeat details or clear up clarifications, and it's a beautiful device for the audience, but it's also really, like, true to who their personalities are. It's like, wait, sorry.
Fits in with the movie, which is kind of a semi-cop, semi-journalism movie.
Yeah.
Southwest?
Correct.
Did you slow down?
Of course we slowed down.
All right.
Listen, dispatch said it was a Negro male.
That was corrected.
No, but at the time they hadn't changed it.
This guy was white. Right, not in a hurry, kind of lumbering along.
Lumbering? Like, what do you mean lumbering?
Shuffling.
Stocky? Had a crew cut?
Yeah, that's all correct.
Like, people make mistakes in these situations and they crucify themselves, and then others go... Like, those guys seem like they'll walk away and go...
partner doesn't.
Isn't it a trope of movies, though? You see it in a lot of movies where the cops always, like, a whole fleet of cops pull into this place and you see the one car driving away.
Yeah.
And they don't stop it. They just let it pass, even though it's, like, right next to the crime scene.
I watched Drive the other week where, like, he evades all these cops and he drives straight into the stadium, and then he walks out with his scorpion jacket over his shoulder, and, like, all the cops flood into the car park and he's just walking out.
There's that beautiful, like, YouTube clip. It was like the bank robbery and the guys run out and just stop, and then all the cops come in and go running in, and then they just pull out and drive away. I think that's the nature of stuff, though. There's adrenaline kicks in. And those guys look like they would just shake that off and go,
you know,
we screwed up. All right, we didn't kill the bloke. All right, there's a lot. We've got it. We're beat cops. All right,
I think it speaks to their own morality in that moment of, like, we should fucking tell someone.
Yeah, because there are consequences.
There's consequences to this. And
listen, it was dark. The guy was wearing a dark jacket. There's no way.
He would have been covered in blood.
When Toski underscores that their missing lumbering man would have been covered in blood, Zelms receives it like a left hook. David Shire's atmospheric score is building, the music mapping the traces that Z left behind. The exact frame of 39 minutes, 47 seconds could and should be framed. It's Anthony Edwards's conveying utter disbelief.
We don't know how serious it is, and when it all breaks down, it's like, you just love that line. He would have been covered in blood.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, shit.
Especially
just forget a reprimand. That line's going to hang around.
It's also what you're going towards as well.
Yeah.
Like, I've had similar situations in my job where, like, there are... Like, I've had to work, like, two nights. On the first night, I had an interaction with someone. And then I went to bed and I woke up And I turned on the news and there was a siege going on with the people that I dealt with the night before, and missed calls on my phone. And I've like rung up and they said, we need you to come into work. I was due to go back in. They're like, we need to talk about things just to make sure everything was right that was done the night before. Because the people I dealt with on the night, that night, they went on, after my interaction, went on and shot someone.
Oh my God.
And then ended up like the SWAT team outside their house. And it was like, we came in, everything was cleared up from our point of view. We couldn't do much. Like, but they were like, wow, I hope you ticked all the boxes before you went home because someone's dead. And you're like, yeah, they luckily were.
Yeah.
But that's just how quickly things can, like, that interaction can turn. Yeah, yeah, it's wild.
The guy was wearing a dark jacket. There's no way.
He would have been covered in blood. Did you stop him? Did you talk to him? Yes? No?
No.
You need to get with the sketch artist. We have to put out a new composite right away.
It's just compounded tragedy after tragedy. These men were so close to the murder and the suspect. They also did have a valid excuse that they had been adhering to an incorrect profile. As Armstrong walks away, the once balanced frame of the officers in their chairs is now only boarded by one man, Dave Toski, the man destined to signify SFPD's enduring legacy of this case. This is the system failing. The system that continues to fail. Ruffalo's Toski cannot hide his bitter disappointment. Just as we transition out of the furnace of that appraisal into Grace Smith's car with his eldest son, here's a discussion with David Fear about Finch's relationship to his father Jack, reflected in Zodiac long before Mank.
It's such a great little thing that he says that, because the choice that he's really faced with there is, do you put in the Prime soundtrack cut or do you put in the Proustian Madeline?
Yes.
And it turns out, you know, he makes the second choice, but it turns out that the first choice
yeah,
is the right choice. And it's funny because how many people, you know, how many people now hear Hurdy Gurdy Man on a radio or whatever the 2021 equivalent of a radio is now, Spotify, I guess, a Spotify shuffle, like Hurdy Gurdy Man comes on and you immediately think of Zodiac. Like, it's just one of those songs that has imprinted itself onto the film and vice versa. They feel inseparable. You know, it's funny. I did a lot of rereading of old press that he did before I talked to him for Mank. And I remember seeing the film when it came out, and I remember reading a lot of the press around it. I always remembered him talking about how personal it was to him, because he, like myself, he grew up in the Bay Area, although he's got about a decade on me, age-wise. And he remembers, you know, seeing the news things or reading the newspapers or hearing his parents talk about it, how that was happening around him as he was coming back. So in a lot of ways, it is this kind of return to childhood. But it wasn't until I talked to him and we were talking about the character of Herman Mankiewicz, not just Herman Mankiewicz as a person, but Herman Mankiewicz as a character in this film that him and his dad, you know, essentially worked on together, if not necessarily together. It wasn't until he said, my dad was very obsessive. A lot of Robert Graysmith is based on him. It's based on his characteristics. And when I went back to watch the film again, because it had admittedly been a while since I'd seen it, or at least seen it without just watching, you know, throwing the commentary track on and watching the commentary, listening to the commentary track and watching it in that frame of mind, as opposed to just as a movie, that I went back and watched it to prep for this and was sort of like, oh my God, like, that's so incredible to know. You look at Robert Graysmith in this entirely different, through these different lens went together as he's putting this character up on screen that is so much of his dad and so much of him trying to like reconcile with that thing with his dad, or if not reconcile, at least sort of, you know, pay homage to it, because Robert Graysmith is a fucked up character. I don't know what he's like in real life. I've never met the man, so I can't speak to him as being a fucked up person. But the Robert Graysmith you get in this movie is like, he is a tarnished white knight. And to think that so much of his dad got put into that, and that was the Robert Graysmith he put up on there, is just, it's so fascinating. You can see so much admiration come through for him now.
And it makes you reread that his great older son character, who's just such a beautiful kid. He's like, I swallowed it.
Yeah.
Why did you swallow it? Because it's minty. It's like, yeah. of course, that pure, it couldn't be more beautiful innocence. And there's that, you know this because, Zodiac Samoa, when you watch a scene sometimes, especially with a movie you're really familiar with, sometimes you just find yourself like, I'm just going to focus on this character for this scene. And I've gone a couple of viewings of Zodiac in the preparation for this show and looked at his son in the scenes because I really want to feel what Finch is going for, because you know that he's being very deliberate with the way that he's framing the son and how the son perceives his dad, and are there any emotional readings you can do? And so it's really funny that maybe that's him. Who's the kid in the movie that's watching all these people absolutely fall apart and like mentally taking notes, and it's actually Fincher? Like, that's who he is. He's this little beautiful observant kid just like watching it all unravel in front of his eyes and kind of like trying with a young mind to process how that even happens.
Yeah, and this is not a film like The Spirit of the Beehive, for example, where it's a massive, either a massive historical moment or event or moment that's being seen through the eyes of the child, and the viewer gets to see it through the eyes of that child. This is just, they're just these little.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Little kind of small throwaway moments, and it happens later in the film too, after he's been married to Chloe Sevigny, and they have their own kids and stuff, where it's, she keeps trying to like get in the way of him watching the TV, pay attention, I'm sitting here, pay attention to me, where you just see these people going into these kind of moral and ethical free falls, and the kids are watching it. He very consciously has reaction shots of the kids just looking at him, these people being like, what the hell is going on? Like, what's happening? And yet you still get, I swallowed it because it was minty. And what's the dad say? He's like, oh, you can't do that, buddy.
Can't like, do that, bud.
Yeah, it's just very tender and very loving and not angry. And it's there's a lot of little small moments in there for being a movie about a very historical mass murderer who eluded capture.
Five persons have been murdered in the San Francisco area, and in each case, the killer who...
I shall wipe out a school bus some morning.
San Francisco Police Department.
To see the Stones in concert this time.
The new letters from the Zodiac Killer were sent to the city room of the San Francisco Chronicle. One of the letters was 7 pages
long.
Graysmith is appraising his son's attempts to disconnect. The Zodiac is occupying his thoughts on every signal, radio in the car, in the television, and eventually in the minds of the reporters in the Chronicle. The Zodiac looms, and so does Graysmith. The details of this case are intoxicating. Let's hear from Brianna Ziegler and Lindsay Romaine about the ways in which this scene inspires a plunge down the rabbit hole with Graysmith.
I feel like there's so many moments in the movie where they make you think they've got it.
Yes.
And then it's just another dead end. And it's like a movie where everything's a dead end, it feels like. And yet nothing feels very unfulfilled, even though like ultimately the case of the Zodiac Killer in real life is very unfulfilled. But I feel very convinced Arthur Lee Allen did it. I actually felt very like certain at the end of this, because then I went on to Reddit for the first time. And I was like Googling, so Arthur Lee Allen did it, right? And like, I was on Reddit and someone offered the idea that it was two people, which I feel like is now like what I think maybe, because it just doesn't make sense that so much of the evidence points towards him, but then what doesn't point towards him is like the hard, like the handwriting and the fingerprints. And I feel like that's the antithesis of the movie.
Yes.
It's just being swathed in uncertainty and ambiguity.
Yes.
And that's what makes it so good. I mean, it's like how many... I don't know how many I've ever seen, but it is like how many crime procedural movies like that just you know, end where nothing is solved. But then there is that just sense of like, I don't know what the word I want is for. It's not fulfilled, but just like when Jimmy Simpson points to Alan, but there's still like that whole scene is so fucking good where they bring him into that room at the airport and they're like, which is the guy? And he immediately points to Alan, but then he's like, but he had a round face like the other guy.
And if I had to put my finger on it, for me, I think the pacing of it is so brilliant because it's a movie where, like I said, you can kind of hop in at different points and there's different moods throughout and there's always something going on. It almost feels like a series of vignettes in certain ways, just in terms of like how it's strung together. So I think that part of it's really appealing to me. But I think for me, like the thing that really hooked me to it the first time, and we've talked a lot about, you know, my love of like Manson stuff. I was really obsessed with serial killers when I was younger. And Zodiac was not, before I saw the movie, I was actually not familiar with the case at all. So I think the part of me that just latches on to stuff like that, that latches on to like a mystery and a conspiracy and a lot of like information to delve into, I think I loved that aspect of it because it really like kindled this desire to do research for a movie. And every time I watch it, I fall down some kind of like Wikipedia hole. and also like, you know, like I said, again, to relate it to Manson, and it's hard not to make the comparison a little bit because
really it happened
around the same time, at least when it started. And in the same place virtually in California. Yeah, a strange time in American history and at the precipice of a lot of things right at the end of the 60s. And there's a lot in the culture going on at that time and a lot that's interesting for me as somebody, as a fan of serial killer stories and also just of films that get into that. It was really, that was kind of around the time I think I was also really obsessed with the Manson family murders and just getting into it. So I think the two kind of worked together in my brain. I was going back and forth reading different bits of information about both cases. And so, yeah, that aspect of it to me is very, I just latch onto it because I'm somebody who finds all that stuff fascinating. And I think the fact that this one's unsolved really, you know, and still unsolved is really something that was so appealing to me because like with a lot of those other cases, you know, you get all the fine details and there's an end point to it. And the fact that this one's unsolved and that is baked into the whole, you know, DNA of this film too. It's about chasing for answers that you'll never get. And yeah, it's frustrating, but it's also part of the appeal of that genre.
The San Francisco Chronicle, one of the living. No, living.
Have you considered the water theory?
What?
Geographically, every attack takes place near a body of water
or water-based name.
Lake Berryessa, Blue Rock Springs, Lake Herman.
Washington, and Cherry?
You think?
No.
I'm reading this book, Homicide Investigation by Lamone Snyder. He says you look for patterns, so I'm looking for patterns.
No. You can't think of this case in normal police terms.
Why not?
You got four crime scenes, Solano, Vallejo, Berryessa, and here, not a single usable print of the first three or in any of the letters?
How does our master criminal come to the city and leave a bloody latent? I mean, assuming the gloves are his, he shoots the cabbie and then takes them off?
So it's not his print.
Maybe, maybe not. You're missing the point. The point is, the first attack,
David Faraday and Betty Jensen,
they both die. From there on out, he only manages to kill the girls.
Not for lack of trying.
Not for lack of trying.
Joe lives, Farron dies. Hartnell lives, Shepard dies. He gets so caught up with the women, he forgets to finish off the men.
Plus, they're all couples and all on lovers' lanes.
Paul Stein is not.
Exactly.
Single male cab driver on Washington and Cherry doesn't fit.
Doesn't fit. So, why does Zodiac kill him?
He's breaking the pattern.
Despite the flurry of this incredibly expository catch-up, moving through different sections of the SFPD and the Chronicle, the filmmakers do something amazing with an incredibly dense factual case. Let's hear from Mariah Gates on what makes Zodiac such an incredible adaptation.
Which is how nonfiction crime usually
it never really feels expository because the story generally is told through the details, like, or how they came across the details or what have you. It's hard sometimes to move that into fiction because, you know, you're not going to just say, oh, there's a basement, but somehow they get that little fact about the basement in the banter.
In
right.
The banter.
And what I think is so clever about how they got those details in is in the book, it is like, I read this in a crime thing and I read this in that report and blah, blah, blah. Instead of showing it in the reports, although there are sections where he's looking through the reports, it's peppered in dialogue in a really clever way that feels like a conversation these detectives would have, but feels bantery. And so it's almost humorous how they're talking to each other. And I think the specific basement line is on the phone, and, you know, they have a really fun rapport on the phone multiple times. And so I think what's clever about how they did that is shown that way and shown when they fly down to Riverside, because there's a whole huge section about the Riverside thing and the,
yes,
and the desk, and there's like a whole chapter just about the desk, right? And you get that moment, but it's only like 3 seconds, and you get kind of the incompetence of it, not incompetence, but it being kind of a red herring.
Yes.
Done through the frustration of the characters, as opposed to the book where it's broken down as if it's really a factor, and you don't necessarily know what's a red herring and what's not
conclusion of the book.
Yeah, until he just lays out every possible thing that it could possibly be until you get to the literal end of the second book.
Yeah.
And then he's like, after I've told you everything that could possibly happen, here it is. Or like the bit with Iona Sky, like, that's a whole other section where all these disappearing women happen, right? And they do it so cleverly where they give you this eerie scene. How is it connected? You're not quite sure. He does it in a really clever way through the soundtrack, because obviously the soundtrack is so important, and these beautiful, you know, 60s, 70s songs become the most eerie fucking things ever. Like, you can't listen to Hurdy Gurdy Man without chills, and you can't listen to I Didn't Promise You a Rose Garden without thinking you're about to die anymore, right? But that's how he ties it in. So in the book, it's just here's another leg of things that could possibly be. In the movie, he's like, here's another pop song murder or almost murder. And that's how it's tied in. And you know it works because of that. And I think that's really clever, because it could just be a tangent, but it feels cohesive because of the way the soundtrack ties it to everything else. And then the Paul, you know, Polt makes Gyllenhaal's character look at all of the different newspaper clippings. And that's the other thing, is like, the facts as they're presented in the books are presented like facts. And in the movie, they're presented in these very specific, heightened, freaky scenes. You know, Paul drunkenly showing Graysmith, you know, the clippings and things like that. And so you're discovering this expository information in really thrilling ways. That feels like how it would be in a book, but in a book, you're always expecting it to be a little more erudite and a little more straightforward. But it's thrilling because you're almost the detective yourself when you're reading it.
Yes.
So it brings that same feeling, but in a more cinematic way. And that's why I think this film, like, after I read the books, that made it even more like clear how brilliant the screenplay and the direction is, that they were able to capture the spirit, but in a totally different way, and pepper in the facts, but in a totally different way.
Yes.
It's amazing. And I recommend, I truly, truly recommend everyone read the books, because there are little tidbits that you know, they're there, and you know, they pile up. But if you read the book, you're like, okay, that one word, like the basement one, that one word, one line is a whole chapter.
Two conversations close, another opens. June Diane Raphael's Mrs. Toski. Sleep answers the phone, just as I sleepily slap my phone to silence to give me another snoozy respite. Here's Meg Shields with a crispy fresh take on Zodiac, Ruffalo, Brian Cox, and spotting some giant intertextual nods.
Should have said this off the bat. I watched the film for the first time for this podcast.
Oh my God.
And, yeah, so this is all coming to you hot and fresh. But when you're talking about basement, so basement gets mentioned, it comes back later. There's like actual bits in this film, like Mark Ruffalo being a big snack boy, loving to eat. And then the one time he puts his food down is when he gets a good piece of intel off Jake Gyllenhaal's character. They're at a diner and Jake Gyllenhaal starts being like, I actually also solve crime. And Mark Ruffalo like slowly puts the burger down. I'm like, well, this must be serious. David Fincher was like, hello, Mr. Cox, I need you to be in on a bit, and I'm gonna, you know, have you be a Muppet. Is that okay? when I thought he only was gonna have the one moment where he, whatever, is summoned on television to coax the killer, but then I think they go back to him later, and I literally cheered. I was like, yes! Back to Belly! Yeah, no, it's funny. Like, speaking of Michael Mann, I definitely, like, had a thing where I was like, he's for like serious dads. And then I finally, you know, got off my high horse and watched some of it and was like, oh, never mind. This is also for very goofy people who like walking into the sea to think. Like, yeah. And then I think I had a similar kind of trepidation about David Fincher, where I was kind of, I understand that he's a good filmmaker. I'm not stupid, but he is very cool. And very withholding and sharp, and that's not always what I'm looking for in a film. Like, I can find his films to be rather clinical and not unfun, but procedural in a way that doesn't like excite me. I need a bit of a push, and I've done my time. I've watched The Game, but I kind of had Zodiac in my mind as being like the clinical, you know, hyper detailed, all these things we associate with David Fincher. And then I watch it and it's very funny. It's a comedy, very chaotic movie. So yeah, I don't know if anyone's listening to the Zodiac podcast who hasn't watched Zodiac. I'm here to tell you, stick your toe in the water.
Guys, come
on. The people who are like very tempted, like still in it.
I insist you should watch it. Got some good stuff.
Exactly. But like the off-screen intro of Brian Cox in a film about hunting serial killers, that's funny.
Yes.
That's a joke.
Yeah.
That is David Fincher trying to tell a joke, and even that as an idea is funny to me.
He's just going to call in on Jim Dunbar's morning show in 3 hours.
On television?
He wants Melvin Belli on to counsel him.
All right. Let's go wake up Melvin. Animal crackers?
Glove box. Are these windows bulletproof?
Yes, Melvin. You'll have to lie down back there.
This man is a marksman. Could snuff me out at a moment's notice.
Are you sure you're up for this?
Don't you worry about me, Inspector. I'll be fine when the lights are on. This man has asked for my help.
The man you're worrying about snuffing you out?
What are these? Cookies? Dear Lord, do you ever clean this car?
Shit.
KG almost tipped other stations.
Just as the car rolls up on the television studio, and we close out the scene for this episode, here's Phil Noble Jr. summing up our theme on this culture-shifting conversation between Zodiac and the media.
It's another layer of tragedy, isn't it? It's because that was the city of love and hope and all the, you know, all of this optimism of the 60s went there, and the Zodiac shot it in the head.
Yes.
That's a pretty dark reading, but you know, you're right. But that idea of not trusting anybody, certainly it got worse in the 70s. Son of Sam, Edmund Kemper, Bundy, like there was an explosion of white men that you shouldn't let change your tire after the Zodiac had his moment. But I think it's significant that Fincher was drawn to the boogeyman of his childhood.
Mm.
You know, and I think that he again, probably he denies it, but I think that there's so many parallels happening there to like this event. And I don't even consider the killings the event. It's the letter writing that really shakes the culture, because they don't even know that these murders are connected right away. Right. It's just, you know, these are killings that are happening, but the letter writing makes it so much more ominous. And he's so omniscient and he's so, you know, one step ahead. That's when people become afraid of him. That's the campaign of terror, and that's what makes him, you know, changes him from a serial killer to a domestic terrorist. Was that letter writing campaign? I think. And it essentially makes him not a serial killer. This is just terrorism, right?
Yeah.
Because he's not following any of the same patterns. and then that spark that you're describing, that unpredictable, that no pattern thing, gets transmogrified into the Dark Knight and then a decade long preoccupation with this Joker character who I just would love to not see in a movie for a little while now. but that's a whole other conversation. But I do think that there's a line here, right? Like whether it's the 9/11 fascination, which I think is obviously part of it, but the idea of this mysterious character waging terror on our home turf, right? In our cities, the place that we call home. I think that without Zodiac, maybe you don't have that version of the Dark Knight.
No, definitely not.
Or of the Joker, rather, in that scene in the Dark Knight. And then there's that weird phenomenon of people who get book deals, I think, about their assertion that their father was this, my father was the Zodiac, or my father was D.B. Cooper. Like, it's a thing where people want to sort of have, like, it's almost like this stolen valor kind of thing where they want to, like, latch on to the fame, right, of it.
That was episode 7. Aries Part 1 of Zodiac Chronicle. Be sure to subscribe to the show so you're the first to know about all upcoming episodes. And if you can't get enough, Unplugged Zodiac Sessions will be available exclusively on the 1-8 Minute Patreon, which is linked in our show notes. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, presented, and produced by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by Mr. Chris Duffy, the Duff of Los Espinas. Our companion, I Am Not Avery, Zodiac Chronicle stickers and pins were done by the talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. Until next time, goodbye.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.